Blog Talk Radio.
Spirit of Truth Ministry now presents The Bible on Trial, a show that tests the teachings of Christianity against the words and the teachings that Jesus Christ gave to his own eyewitness disciples while he was here on earth. Join us for a challenging and unique study into truth, justice, and the kingdom of heaven. Hello, everyone. Welcome to The Bible on Trial. My name is Dennis, and I am here with the Spirit of Truth Ministry team this morning, including Suzette, Dr. Don, and Rick. And we are glad that you are here with us. It's nice to see Roger up with us today. And one of these days, Roger will have to meet in person. That would be really nice. Let us go first to our chat room. I want to call attention to the fact that I have put up on our chat room that is connected to our Blog Talk Radio website the pertinent information that you need to be able to get the information that we're giving or to get in contact with us should you choose. Our primary website is spiritoftruthministry.net. There you will find our book, The Spirit of the Church, which Rick and I wrote and was published in 2007. We also have the Grand Plan, parts 1-7, that Rick has basically completed. And you can go there and read that. That is a fabulous, both of those are fabulous primers to what it is that Spirit of Truth is all about. Our original website, located at spiritoftruthministry.net/STM, where those last three letters are in caps. There you will find not only some historical data and some biographical data, but you will find some very interesting writing by other people, including Rick, but other people other than Rick. And we encourage you to go there, bookmark those two so that you can have them for your reference points. Our email is at spiritoftruthministry@gmail.com. And our mailing address is at Post Office Box 1013, Calamasa, California, 92320. Let's have prayer, and then we will get started with our program. Father in Heaven, Jesus Christ, Holy Spirit, our Mother, whose name is Wisdom, I thank you for being here today to lead us into truth. Amen. Just a little little side. I don't know how many of you had a chance to read what I posted onto the Facebook group page this morning, but it is an interesting take on what is easy and what is hard. We think in terms of my wife is a licensed clinical social worker. Her master's degree is in social work. And one of the things that she wrote in her thesis after we talked about it, and I kind of did, Rick, I did for her what I do for you, just kind of help clarify things. You know, I don't get the ideas. I kind of make them maybe a little more easily understandable to the to other people. But she wrote in her thesis that everyone takes the road of least difficulty. Whenever we're faced with a decision, we almost always choose the road, not the road that is less traveled, but the road that is more traveled. Because we want company. We want the assurance that we're doing it right, that you know, if everybody believes it, then it must be right. And I pointed out that when I was growing up, that my dad I put it this way in a mild way, I would challenge his fatherly authority, and he would then come to me and say, son, we can do this the easy way or we can do this the hard way. You choose. And there were a couple of times I chose the hard way. I learned from those experiences that the hard way, the easier road down the road, and that the easy road is often the hard road down the way a little bit. The hard way only seems easy. What? Well, Jesus said it the best that I know when he was talking with Nicodemus. We have been told from our teachers on the pulpit, in classrooms and religious leaders, that we must come to the light and then we can learn to practice the truth. Then we can learn the truth and then we can do it. But remember, it's not doing the truth that's the most important thing. It's just recognizing that you're not there and you need God and you need to believe that you're saved by grace through faith. Exactly, Rick, that Jesus is all the truth that you need to know. But Jesus said this to Nicodemus: he who practices the truth comes to the light. That seems awfully backwards, doesn't it? So what I wrote was this: life is full of occasions that give each of us the opportunity to choose either the right way or the wrong way, or of believing. For me, it was learning from my father that making the right choice at first may seem as if it is difficult. But as you grow in your understanding of these life situations, the hard decisions become easier, until you wonder how it was that you could have been so stupid as to believe the wrong choice was the right choice. When we believe by faith that we are saved through grace, we are believing the wrong choice as if it is the right one. And it is very difficult to turn that around. And the only way to turn it around is to do exactly what Jesus said in John 3:19, which is, he who practices the truth comes to the light so that his deeds may be manifested as having been wrought in God. So that's my little spiel for the morning. By the way, today is, if I'm not mistaken, January 19, 2018. Wow, yeah. The month has gone by pretty quick.
Time is going by.
It's just, I can't believe how fast last year went, so fast.
Right. By the way, good morning, Suzette.
Morning.
Morning, Dr. Don.
Good morning.
And good morning to everyone, our listeners, and that you find our study discussion today interesting and helpful. And
looks like Linda.
Helping your understanding to grow.
Good morning, Linda.
Ask any Christian if they know God, and what do you think they would tell you?
Well, that is actually obvious. I have asked that question to more Christians than I can count, just by way of starting a conversation, and they all say, yes, I know the Lord. Mm-hmm. I know the Lord.
Intimately know him.
Yeah, I have a personal relationship with him. That's exactly what they say.
Yeah.
And by the way, that is the goal of every Christian today. That is to have a deep personal relationship with Jesus Christ. then the follow-on question that I have had the courage to ask occasionally, and I did ask of those two young ladies that I talked on the road with my walking my dogs, just how is that done? How is that accomplished?
If they know God, were they born with this knowledge, knowing God? So how did they come to know God? You ask them, do you know God? And they say, yes. Then you say, how do you know?
They learn it from what they're being taught in church.
Okay. Very good, Suzette. Now, that would imply, then, that the person doing the teaching in church knows God. So if you were to ask the pastor or the Sabbath school or Sunday school teacher mm-hmm. who has been informing their membership about God, if you ask them if they know God, what would they say?
Of course they know him, personally.
They would say they know God.
Sure.
Okay. How do they know they know God?
Because they've had the same thing done to them. They've learned it in church from the people who are supposed to know.
It's sort of like the philosophical question, how do you know whether you're awake or asleep? No. See, again, Christians believe they're awake when they're asleep. Many, many, most. You know, it's like 99% of them believe that they're awake and the other 1% is lying.
Let's say that someone sends a letter where the person sending the letter is in one part of the world and the person the letter is sent to is in another part of the world. And this person informs this other person that they are coming. This is how they will recognize them when they come. Put down this description. So when this person shows up, the person who received the letter looks at them and they say, oh, I know you. Now they have a whole group that they've informed that this person is coming from another part of the world and this is how they are and da-da-da-da and this is how they'll recognize them. So they show up. Tell me how they can be certain that that person is who they said they were. Especially if someone else shows up and says they're so-and-so, which is the same name, how do you know which is which? You see how important it is to know whom you are expecting and to know that the information you have is verifiable and true. Let's say that this person who sent the information to this other person was only pretending to be the one who was expected. When we look back through history, We know for a fact that the children of Israel never knew their God. They knew of their God. They would bring their sacrifices into the temple. Or they were worshiping at their altars and their Asherah poles and bowing down to their household idols. What happened? Why did the children of Israel not know the God of the fathers, the God that had led them out of Egypt and given them this land and made many promises? Why is it they did not know this God? Or did they know this God? They may have known of him. They may have kept the feasts. They may have practiced in accordance with what the priests were telling them. But did the priests know God? Now, of all people who should know God, the priests should know God, right? Because they have the temple and they have the law. And the law, what is the law? They have the law. What is the law? Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. And for the children of Israel, that was and is their Bible. Right?
Yes.
Is that not what priests had to learn from, to learn about their God?
That and the prophets that occasionally came along to define things.
First it was the judges.
Right.
Then came the prophets. The prophet came because the children of Israel wanted a king.
And Samuel was the crossover on that one.
Why would the children of Israel ask for a king? Because they didn't know their God. If they knew their God, they would never ask for a king. Samuel, one of the greatest judges to ever live, was also one of the greatest prophets to ever live. In fact, Samuel was the last judge and the first prophet. Samuel knew God, but even though they would listen to Samuel, they would not do what Samuel said. The prophets were sent Why were their prophets needed? And what were the prophets sent for? Who was the they call them major prophets. Who was the first major prophet? And why was he sent?
Was that Jeremiah or Isaiah?
Isaiah.
So Samuel wasn't the first prophet.
Jeremiah was
a major prophet.
No, Samuel was the first prophet. He was the last judge and the first prophet.
So Isaiah was first major prophet.
Isaiah was the first major prophet. And I don't know if you've noticed or not, when you read Isaiah, the book of Isaiah does not start with the calling of Isaiah to be a prophet. The book of Isaiah starts off with some rather dire warnings. It isn't until the sixth chapter that we see the account of the call of Isaiah. Isaiah is the one who sees this vision of God in his throne room, and the angels and the glory, and it actually says in there, and the glory of God filled the whole earth. Was that true at that time, or was that going to be true at some point in time in the future? Well, you know, when we look at Revelation, we recognize that what is being described in Revelation is primarily going to happen in the future. So Isaiah sees this. And you know what is really interesting about what Isaiah is told? So turn to Isaiah chapter 6. In the year of King Uzziah's death, I saw the Lord Yahweh seated on a high throne. His train filled the sanctuary. Above him stood seraphs, each one, and they cried out one to another in this way: Holy, holy, holy is Yahweh Sabaoth. His glory fills the whole earth. Does that sound somewhat familiar? Sounds like Revelation 5, 4 and 5, yes. Then Isaiah talks about being a wretched man and so on and so forth. Then one of the seraphs flew to me, holding in his hand a live coal, which he had taken from the altar, and with a pair of tongs. With this he touched my mouth and said, "See, now this has touched your lips. Your sin is taken away. Your iniquity is purged." Then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send? Who will be our messenger?" I answered, "Here I am. Send me." Why was God inaugurating a prophet? From what I understand, this was right around somewhere 742 BCE. And it was right around 600 BCE when the southern kingdom was taken into captivity, or at least Jerusalem was under siege. So just about 150 years later. Why was God calling a prophet? Because the end of Israel was coming. The final judgment. Why was God doing this? Why was he going to have his people taken into captivity? Had God failed? I mean, his plan was, is he took these people out of Egypt into the wilderness, gave Moses the law. He spoke to Moses. Moses wrote down the words of the law. The law, we have said, is the Bible. It's like to us today, the Bible. I said like the Bible. I didn't say it is. Because the Bible is a compilation put together by man, which contains the law and contains the testimony of Jesus, as well as the testimony of the eyewitnesses who accompanied him, John and Matthew. Why is God authorizing a prophet such as Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel, and then the minor prophets, Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk, Zephaniah, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, because Israel never accomplished what God had given them to accomplish. What did they need to accomplish? They needed to learn righteousness. They needed to obey him. They had the law. Now, back then, of course, most of the people couldn't read. The priests could read, and the priests could read the law. They had access to the law. In fact, my understanding is that they had memorized the law. They could quote the whole law from memory. So the priests should have known God, Yahweh. They should have known because they knew the law. They read the law. And just like today, shouldn't the pastors know God? Because they have their Bible. They preach from the Bible. They teach from the Bible. They've taken theology. Most have gone to the seminary. Should they not know God? And you ask them, do you know God? What will they tell you?
Of course.
I would say, by and large, most of them would say, yes, I know God. Turn to Jeremiah chapter 2. And I am going to read verses 8 and 9. The priests have never asked, where is Yahweh? Those who administer the law have no knowledge of me. The shepherds have rebelled against me. The prophets have prophesied in the name of Baal, following things with no power in them. So I must put you on trial once more. It is Yahweh who speaks, and your children's children too. So why are the people of Israel in the expectation of their God? Because they don't know their God? And why do they not know their God? I mean, isn't their God right there with them? Don't they have the temple in Jerusalem? Don't they have priests in their various cities? Why don't they know their God? The shepherds, the priests, or the shepherds, have rebelled against me. Now, what would it mean, rebelled against me? What does he mean by the priests have rebelled against me?
They aren't teaching his testimony.
They're not teaching his testimony, but they have the law. It says it right there. They administer the law. They have made themselves into what they want to be. Now, let's take that to now. Who are the priests now?
Pastors, Bible teachers.
Okay. And of course, they are would be shepherds, right? Isn't that what pastor means?
That's right.
And what is the responsibility of the shepherds?
To protect their sheep.
And to, in the spiritual sense, yes.
Yeah,
teach them what?
The truth.
Teach them about the true shepherd.
Right.
The good
shepherd. Yeah.
Now, if you think about my original opening illustration, and you know what I have demonstrated about what the Son of God taught and what Paul taught. Now, if the devil showed up and he looked just like what Christians expected Christ to look like, and when he spoke, his words were loving and kind and accepting. And people would say, this is, he's everything that I ever thought and more. And started speaking in terms of what Paul had said that Jesus Christ is. You know, he started saying, I've covered you with my righteousness. I know that you are all sinners. And I know that that's all you can ever be. And I just want you to know that there will be no judgment for you because you all have accepted me and you all believe in me. How many Christians do you think would flock to that being?
All of them.
Saying, this is our God. We have waited for him and he will save us.
By the way, it's interesting because what we're talking about is what I wrote about, and we never talk about this, do we? It's interesting.
Yeah.
Do you think that God would ever allow something like that to happen where people would be so completely deceived and not even know it?
He will.
I didn't ask about free will. I said, okay. Do you think that God would ever allow that?
No, no. Of course he would, because he has.
That's right.
Of course he would allow that, because he already has.
The world is lost.
They're deceived.
They're deceived, not necessarily lost correctly.
Here's the thing. God will give everyone an opportunity
to learn the truth.
To learn the truth with enough validity that those who are honest with themselves will recognize it.
Yeah.
And he's even going to cause circumstances to occur on this earth so that people will go, the end is here. The earth cannot sustain these events like this and continue on anymore. And so I know that the end of the world has come. But God will have not shut the door on them yet. But that's a whole different situation than how that process starts. Now, back in the day when Israel was living in the promised land and they didn't know God and the priest didn't know God, and their time was running out, God contacted prophets to warn not only the priests, but the people, particularly the people.
Mm-hmm.
Who stood as the greatest roadblock, the prophets that God called to warn, to sound the warning?
The leadership of the Jews, those who should have known better.
And who do you think will stand as the greatest roadblock against those who are proclaiming the end of the world? I would suspect that it would be the same class of people, the pastors,
yes,
the theologians.
They think they know it all.
There is a huge difference between what God did with the children of Israel and what God will do at the end of time. Do you know what that is? He is going to have prophet and prophets who will be saying that time is just about up. And none of you, including your religious teachers, the pastors, the evangelists, the theologians, none of you know what you're talking about, and you do not know the God you claim to be teaching people about. What do you think their response would be?
Get away from me, you're sick.
Why would people think that if all through history, all through the history of God's people, that things would be much different at the end of time than they had been throughout all of history? I mean, think about it. We read in Jeremiah where God says, the priests have the law, but they don't know me. The priests have the law, but they don't know me. And then we read in Matthew chapter 21 this statement. Starting with verse 42, 21, verse 42. Jesus said to them, these are the religious teachers, the priests, the scribes, the Pharisees. Have you never read in the scriptures, that's the Bible, by the way, their Bible.
Right.
It was the stone rejected by the builders that became the chief cornerstone. This was the Lord's doing, and it was wonderful to see. I tell you then that the kingdom of God will be taken away from you and given to a people who will produce it fruit. The chief priests and the scribes realized he was speaking about them. But though they would have liked to arrest him, they were afraid of the crowds who looked on him as a prophet. What were the prophets doing? What was the prophet's responsibility? To warn the people that the final judgment was coming.
Mm-hmm.
What is he doing here? He's saying, okay, we, the Father and I, gave you the kingdom. We promised it to Abraham, your forefather. And you had it, and we gave you a land, and we told you what you needed to do, and you never did it. So we had to judge you, and you were taken away into captivity. You had to leave the land. But we gave you a second chance, and we let you go back to the land. But you didn't learn from your previous mistakes. In fact, you committed them and more. And now here you are at the end. That 77s that we talked about to Daniel. Here we are at the end. Your king, your Messiah is here, right here, standing in front of you. And you have built this spiritual house, and the king of your spiritual kingdom is not what you expected. So that stone that was to complete the house, the capstone, you rejected it. Because it was not what you wanted. So your house is left to you desolate, unfinished. And the kingdom, the spiritual kingdom that we gave to you to build, we are taking away. Because you've blown it twice. We know you will never accomplish it. You've rejected me, your king, and so we, my father and I, are taking the kingdom away from you, and we will give it to a people who will accomplish this. He didn't say, we will give it to them to accomplish, and hopefully they will do it. He said, we will give it to a people who will accomplish the purpose for which it is. How does that work out? Is it going to be the same way? Is God going to call a people out of the world into the wilderness to teach them about himself and take them into a land, the promised land, and say, here it is. Now, this is what I want you to do. Is that what it's going to, how it's going to work out again? No. Everything that God has given throughout the last 3,000 years is all that we need to know to accomplish the building of his kingdom. From Genesis to Malachi, to Matthew, Mark, and John. That is all we need. And with John, we have 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John and Revelation. That is all anyone needs to accomplish what God has purposed for his people to accomplish. So those who say that we needed a prophet to come and bring things up to date, the Jehovah's Witness had Charles Russell, the Mormons had Joseph Smith, the Seventh-day Adventists had Ellen G. White, and the Catholics have the Pope. Why? I mean, if there was a prophet needed after the Son of God, then the Son of God did not tell us everything we needed to know. And the Son of God tells us that the law contains everything we need to know. And he came to testify to that law. But things have changed somewhat. The requirements have not changed, but things have changed somewhat. God is not going to call a prophet like he did Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel. The calling of the prophet will be like Daniel. How did God call Daniel?
He didn't.
He didn't. Daniel didn't know he was, I mean, Daniel was a captive. And because Daniel was part of the royal family, when he was taken captive, Nebuchadnezzar put the royal family members in his palace because they tended to be educated and more familiar with the workings of what was going on in administration. And so he would bring them in there, and Daniel and his three friends were given positions in the king's cabinet as counselors or advisors. And you know the story. The king had a vision. What did his vision concern?
The future.
The future. Primarily, the end. Now, his vision had a progression of kingdoms of the world. And not until the very end, in the days of the beast, because this vision, you know, was this huge statue of a man. Not until the feet did the God of heaven set up a kingdom that would never be destroyed and never be replaced by other people. Not until the feet. So from the head of gold through to the end of the legs of iron into the feet of iron and clay, the God of heaven did not have a kingdom.
From when to when?
From the head of gold until the feet of iron and clay.
Wow.
The God of heaven did not have a kingdom. It was in the days of the kings of the feet that the God of heaven set up a kingdom. It was a stone cut out without hands. Cut out without hands. That is a very telling description. Daniel was not a part of the group that the king consulted to tell him the meaning of his vision. And those that he did, he would not tell what he saw. And he recognized that all of these guys were frauds, and that if they were frauds, he didn't want them in his palace. He didn't want them in his kingdom. He didn't even want them alive because they weren't worth the breath that they drew to live. So he sentenced them all to death, all, including everyone that was among his advisors and his counselors, everyone. They were all to be put to death. So that included Daniel and his three friends. Daniel trusted his God.
And why did he trust his God? Because he knew his God.
Now, we know that Daniel knew Jeremiah, or at least knew of Jeremiah. He probably knew Jeremiah. He probably had heard him. But he had some writings of Jeremiah. Now, I don't know if Jeremiah wrote this before the captivity or if Jeremiah wrote it. He wrote it during the captivity, and he sent letters to the captives in Babylon, which is what Daniel had. Daniel knew about prophets, and he knew that God gave prophets information the prophets would give to the king and the priests and the people. So if Nebuchadnezzar knew this was a vision that he had received, not a dream that he had forgotten what it was and needed to be reminded of what it was. Daniel knew that Nebuchadnezzar knew what that vision was. And only those who would be able to relay it to him accurately would be listened to. So Daniel, of course, asked, don't do anything. Ask the king if he can wait until I ask my God, and if my God is willing, he will give him his dream and the meaning of it. And Daniel prayed, and God gave him the vision and the interpretation.
One of the things he brought up, actually years ago, was that Nebuchadnezzar was brilliant in the fact that he didn't tell his advisors what his dream was. He was going to make them tell him. Mm-hmm. And the only reason why Daniel had any traction at all is because Daniel told Nebuchadnezzar the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had not told anybody.
That Nebuchadnezzar had been told not to reveal the dream to anybody.
Oh, that's probably very true.
But Nebuchadnezzar, being told not to reveal the dream to anybody, wanted to know what the meaning of the dream was, but he couldn't tell anybody what the dream was.
Yeah. Which provided Daniel the in that he needed in order to become what he eventually became to the king.
Which was kind of a roundabout way of calling Daniel. In Matthew chapter 24, 42 to 51. So stay awake, because you do not know the day when your master is coming. You may be quite sure of this, that if the householder, that's the head of the house, had known at what time of night the burglar would come, he would have stayed awake and would not have allowed anyone to break through the wall of his house. Therefore, you too must stand ready, because the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect. So when should we be expecting him?
When we don't.
How could you have an expectation if you didn't have any way of effective on time? so that you could be expecting?
You would have to know the time, and then that time would have to come and go.
And it would not be the time you expected.
And it would not be the time you expected.
What sort of servant, then, is faithful and wise enough?
By the way, that is an interesting qualifier. Enough.
Yeah. For the master to place him over his household to give them their food at the proper time. Now, here's a proper time, but that he's coming when he's not expected, at the expected time. So there's a proper time, but the expected time is not
the proper
time when he comes.
Right.
Happy that servant if his master's arrival finds him at this employment. I tell you solemnly. You know, that I tell you solemnly, that's like, this is serious. He will place him over everything he owns. But as for the dishonest servant who says to himself, my master is taking his time, and eats about, and sets about beating his fellow servants and eating and drinking with drunkards, his master will come on a day he does not expect. There's that expect again. And at an hour he does not know. The master will cut him off and send him to the same fate as the hypocrites, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. It sounds very clear to me that this faithful and wise enough servant has not had the same type of calling that Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel and the others had. This servant is feeding his fellow servants food. But as you all know, this food is spiritual food. He's not having a potluck. This is talking about spiritual food. And what spiritual food would this servant be feeding his fellow servants?
And we'll find out tomorrow. So there's a good hook. Thank you for joining us today. We encourage you to join us tomorrow at 10 a.m. Pacific time for another edition of The Revelation of Jesus with Rick Sterling. We also encourage you to go to our website at spiritoftruthministry.net and also go to our Facebook page, Spirit of Truth group page. So on behalf of Spirit of Truth Ministry, this is Dennis saying so long for now. We'll see you all tomorrow.